I'm so excited, man.
Get in bed with an alien and listen to the Uncut Gems podcast. It's the weekly show where we talk about movies nobody else wants to talk about. It's episode number 69, lol. And my name is Jakub.
My name is Nick.
And today we're also joined by our good buddy Randy. Randy, how are you doing?
Good. I'm doing great, guys. Good to be here.
Awesome. 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 Okay, so glad to have you all with us. You know, it's amazing that we're doing this. Also, this is, and this may be episode number 69, but it's officially episode number 2 of Jakub flying by the seat of his pants.
We love to see it.
Zero script. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of ums and ahs in here, so strap yourselves in. Anyway, before we start, might as well mention, on the Patreon, the full set of May episodes is now available, so that includes the Invasion of the Body Snatchers bonus tie-in to the Shapeshifters and Body Snatchers marathon that we've just about started last week with the Thing from Another World on the regular show. Also, the retrospective with Shivers, Invaders from Mars, and Body Snatchers by Abel Ferrara available on the Patreon, as well as the newest installment in the David Lynch marathon. That up until recently, Niccolo has been confessionally referring to as David Lynch retrospective, and it's just like every single time he says marathon, he just does it just like I have a little bit of like a spite because I pointed it out once.
Like, doesn't roll off the tongue. I have to focus very hard.
It's like it's David Lynch marathon, like Jesus Jakob. Anyway, so they're all available. Meanwhile, on the I might as well say because one of our recent reels on TikTok got us our first hate mail, or at least hate comment. Someone called us morons and then told us that we shouldn't be allowed to express our opinions online. So that's all, folks.
Because we didn't like Crawl.
Yeah.
Badge of honor, honestly.
So yeah, we got ourselves some, like, and we stepped into like a Crawl sort of zealotry sort of nest of snakes. I don't know. But it's fun. Got a lot of likes out of that. I mean, a lot. Not a lot, but you know, because there are 16-year-olds who get millions of likes out of showing other people's cars. I don't know. Anyway, so there's that. Might as well mention before we do any of this, also on the Patreon next month, just strap yourselves in because we're reaching the apogee, the zenith of the David Lynch marathon. Because we'll be talking about Twin Peaks. So, $3 a month, patreon.com/uncutgemspod is the place. $3 buys you access to pretty much everything that we do. No tiers, no nothing, one single tier, just $3 a month is all it takes to listen to more of our shit.
And if you don't do it, there's my tiers because you're not subscribed.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, so meanwhile, what we're doing today is we're continuing our Shapeshifters and Body Snatchers series, which is slowly running up to the 40th anniversary of the release of John Carpenter's The Thing. So we're talking about science fiction. That's a bit weird. And then in that spirit, we're talking about Species.
Whoa.
What's the matter?
Take it easy. Just relax. There's plenty of time. What is it? Oh no, I think someone's at the door.
Don't go. Please. I want a baby.
What? Excuse me?
directed by Roger Donaldson, who also did, I think, Dante's Peak, Cocktail, The Bounty, and The 13 Days, among other things. Starring Natasha Henstridge, Ben Kingsley, Michael Madsen, Alfred Molina, Forrest Whitaker, and Michelle Williams. A bunch of people in here. And other people as well. So Species is kind of a sci-fi thriller about, I think, Syl. That's Natasha Henstridge. Was a human alien hybrid developed by NASA experiment who escapes captivity and unleashes upon the world, leaving a trail of bodies behind her. And while she is searching for, a suitable mate, then NASA sends a group of scientists and bounty hunters and mercenaries with a mission to find and kill her. And that's pretty much the movie. So anyway, it was written by Dennis Feldman, who also did The Golden Child. And I think that there's a story to be told in there. I'm not sure if we're gonna get to it, but I think the film originated like a police procedural, and then it went through quite a lot of changes before it became what it became. And then I think one of the most important, interesting sort of wrinkles to it was that the filmmakers got H.R. Giger to get involved to design the alien in question. And I think these connections to H.R. Giger and then through H.R. Giger to Ridley Scott's Alien, I think we're going to talk about some more. So apparently that was a big hit for MGM and United Artists, who actually, I think the film cost, $35 million to make, and then just quadrupled that. Spawned three sequels, two of them straight to TV, a comic book, and a novel. So it became its own, like, it's one of those films, and it was released in 1995, so it's one of those sort of 90s oddities that kind of just for some reason took a life of its own. I think very early on in the show we talked about what Alien Nation was, one of those things that kind of just became a TV show and a comic book and something else. It's just ridiculous. Anyway, but the critics didn't like it. Some people thought there was just, this film was a blatant excuse to get Natasha Henstridge to strip naked and walk around topless half the time. So, where are you guys on this? Do you like Species, or were you too distracted by Natasha's Henstridge's ample body? So
how can you be distracted by that?
Well, I don't know. Anyway, more on that later. Randy, tell us what you think about Species.
So I feel that one of the best years in cinema is 1995, and I
preach.
Think you guys have been great to have me on a couple of times. You guys have covered a few 1995 films. The other episode I was on for 1995 film was Johnny Mnemonic, and now here I am with Species. So I am somehow avoiding the true uncut gems here. But I will say this about Species. I saw it in theaters in 1995 leading up to its release. It had a kick-ass, exciting promo campaign. This looked like it was going to be a very, very, very cool film. It turned out, though, to be fairly bland. It's not a great script, but what it does have, it's got amazing iconography. This has imagery galore. It's got imagery you can market. It's got a gorgeous, naked, young Natasha Henstridge.
This is what you were referring to when you were saying iconography. It has.
Well, it is. It is, because you've got this naked model. And you've got a creature not unlike Alien in its appearance. And you mentioned H.R. Giger designed it. You've got horror visuals. You also have what I'd call a semi-hot mid-90s type of cast, where you've got, you know, a couple cool British actors that seem to have poise, and then you've got a likable actor in there like Forrest Whitaker, and you have sort of a dark horse indie darling in Michael Madsen. You just have a lot of vibrant potential pieces for a movie, but at the end of the day, it's like a pizza that has some very interesting and tasty toppings, but the crust and the sauce aren't all that great.
Soggy bottoms.
It's a It's very much, in my view, a middle of the road type of film. But there's some fun to be had in here. So, you know, as I think I said at Johnny Mnemonic, we'll see how the conversation goes. Maybe I'll be swayed definitively more one way than the other. But for me, it's a very midline type of film. There's some cool stuff, but two, there's a lot of slop.
Nice. Nico, tell us all. What do you think?
Let me talk about my lunch today. I went to Burger King after a long time.
What a segue.
Nice.
Because I was looking online, I was like, oh, cool, Burger King has a new Italian King's burger, because it's, you know, it's Italian specific hamburgers. And they tend to like them, even though they're just kind of like, you know. But this one had red onions, and they like red onions. I was like, let's go pick it up. Let's go try it. Ordered it, looked at it. Of course, it doesn't look nothing like the pictures. Like, oh, fair enough. But the onions are there at least. I bite into it. It's fine. There's some like gourmet mayo sauce that they use. I don't know what it's called. It's like actually called like gourmet mayo in the menu, whatever. I was like, it's good.
Aioli.
I wish. No, I wish. Aioli is king, supreme. That's the proper king. And so I ate it. I was like, this was all right. And then like around 4 p.m. I started feeling it in my belly. And I'm still kind of feeling it there.
Oh, boy.
It was, in the moment, it was kind of all right, but a bit disappointing. But now I kind of regret eating it. That's species. That's species for me. In the moment, it was all right, but it's been like 3 days. I'm like, this gave me absolutely nothing good in my body. I'm just feeling, if anything, it just gave me negative things. I didn't digest it well. It's not sitting well in me. It ain't good. It ain't good, Chief. It has the red onions, though. It has the red onions. It has some good things. I'm kind of like, well, at least they were both of them. At least there was something good there, you know. It's not worth it.
No.
There's better meals to be had.
Well, you know, your description reminded me of that time when I almost shot myself while watching Wonder Wheel at the cinema.
Oh,
that was a close call.
Good memories.
No. It's a long story.
Get for watching Woody Allen in the cinema.
I think gods were playing tricks on me. I think, no, because I ate a dodgy Scotch egg before that. And that was a big mistake. I think I detailed it all in my Letterboxd review of this. So yes, head over to letterboxd.com/Jakub Flash and find my review of Wonder Wheel.
I've had a bad experience with a Scotch egg once, you know.
There's no such thing as a good experience with a Scotch egg, let's put it that way.
I've had good experiences, but I've learned the hard way you shouldn't microwave a Scotch egg.
Oh, no, never. Just a rookie mistake.
You've had Scotch eggs, Randy, right?
I have not.
It's basically an egg that's covered with meat. That's basically what it is. Like
and
a
crust.
Fried. It's this fried meat thing with an egg inside. And I was like, oh, let's just heat it up. I put it in a microwave. After 2 minutes, I removed. It's like a balloon. And I take the fork. I poke it gently with the fork and it splattered all over the room. And I got burnt on my face because it was so boiling hot. And it was in the dorm. And I had to scrape egg off the ceiling.
That's what you get for microwaving a Scotch egg. Like, the egg came on your face.
Well, that should fit in nicely with Canadian cuisine. I'll have to try that.
Oh, wow. So I'm hoping you're also aware of pork pies, right? Because that's also a very British snack. It also should not be microwaved. But then, anyway, I don't know what you're like. Oh, there's no such thing as a good experience with a Scotch egg, because maybe that's just my digestive system. Like, it's like the next shit after a Scotch egg is always going to be an emergency.
Anyway, species.
I'll put it this way. For some reason, I have access to 3 out of 4 species films. I don't have access to the species 4 Awakening.
That's probably the good one.
Yeah, so I have access to three of them on my Amazon Prime add-on subscription that I, for some reason, just subscribed to have access to the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Anyway, so I thought to myself, I know what I'll do. I'll watch the first one, and then at least I'll watch the second one, because that was also released in cinema. So at least I'll just watch the two that weren't made for sci-fi. I watched the first one. I was thinking to myself, I think I'm done. I think I don't... I don't need the second one in my life. Like one was more than enough, way more than enough. So I hope this puts this in perspective. This is not a good film, and then this is one of those films from 1995 that I remember seeing this on VHS rental store shelves. I remember the posters. I remember this being in cinemas, and I remember not being admitted into them because I was 11, and they were, for some reason, they didn't want me in films that had nudity in them, so I was turned away from Showgirls. disappointed. and I was not allowed to buy a ticket to buy Species, to go and see Species for some reason. So I, yeah, there's that. And also I have a little correction, because I was speaking to my cousin when I went to visit the family over in Poland, and we were talking about movies, and for some reason we ended up talking about Johnny Mnemonic. And it turns out, because I think in the episode I mentioned that it wasn't a big screen experience for him, and he was like, yeah, we saw it together in the cinema. Like, really? Yeah, great. So I saw Johnny Mnemonic in the cinema in 1995. That was great. Anyway, Species. That's not a good film. I think that's just an understatement. It's not very good. Although I think I agree with Randy the most. I think it has its moments of where it's fun, but it's actually one of those sort of moments where you're the film's not fun in its own right. You're kind of having fun because the film's kind of stupid.
Yeah.
I'll put it that way. There is a moment up after which it just goes like off the cliff, right? It's just like, no, I'm not having this. And like the entire ending of the film is like, no. It's just, I'm not on board with any of this. I'm sorry. Whoever wrote this or directed, what's his name? Feldman. Corey Feldman? No, Dennis Feldman.
What?
Corey Feldman did not write Species. Sorry.
This film needed Corey Feldman. Needed the Coreys.
And Corey Haim directed it. And you know, was there a film with Corey Haim and Corey Feldman with the two Coreys?
Oh, there were three or four.
Oh, and this is a job for the Google Brigade. Anyway, so. I don't think I like this film, although it has its moments. It wears its sort of references to other science fiction films on its sleeve. And then I think this is going to be an interesting conversation in its own right, more than the film is interesting. but I was watching this and I was just thinking to myself, like, why was this such a taboo situation? It's just boobs. And then I realized they're everywhere. This like for some reason Natasha Henstridge signed up onto her screen big screen debut into a film where she's constantly naked in such a weirdly gratuitous way. So I don't know, it's such a weird film, and then it's weird. I mean, sometimes it's fun weird, and sometimes it's just annoying weird. So I think I might as well just get to the nitty gritty of this, because I think in general terms, I think I know where we're all standing. So I don't even know where to go with this. Like, why is it bland? What's going on? Like, because we know, I think it goes without saying, this film has Alien written all over it, right?
Yes.
And Terminator, frankly.
Ooh, that's a Terminator 3? Or just Terminator?
Well, just Terminator, so you have a supposedly, you know, heartless killer of some sort, you know, walking around naked until she finds a way to clothe herself. You know, it does have some of that.
But then she disrobes for some reason, just, that's me now.
That's the biology and procreation theme.
yeah, anyways.
I know why this movie sucks.
Okay.
It's because it doesn't know what it wants to be. because you have two different movies at play here.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, you have aliens. You have the team, crackdown team of diverse individuals with quirky personalities that band together to find this alien and destroy it. Fair enough. On the other hand, you have the alien being a sympathetic character that's only trying to survive in a world that doesn't understand it, that's treated it only with hate since it was born, which is fascinating. And I think I want to watch that movie. And I think at first it delivers. And you were saying the first part is fun. And I agree, actually. The first part where you're introduced to the character who's played, of Syl, who's played by a young
Michelle Williams,
it's like you care for her. You kind of like, oh, she's going to be the protagonist. Oh, but then we're introduced to the team. I go, okay, but it's going to build, like, it's building this dynamic where you feel for the alien. That's what it's doing. You like her, you care for her, you're rooting for her, you want her to be safe. Oh yeah, she does kill a couple of people on the way, but it's fine. But then they kind of abandon any type of development and sympathy for her. And it's like, I don't care anymore. Why should I care? You spent 40, 50 minutes trying to make something deeper than this movie actually is. I don't know what went wrong in the script writing process, because allegedly it's been written just by one man. Maybe it was changed around by the producers. Who knows?
Because, it's been changed by the guy himself. He wrote it in 1987.
Terrible.
And then he rewrote it. It was supposed to be like, I don't know. It was supposed to be like a whole manner of things. It was called The Message first, by the way. It was supposed to be a police procedural. And yeah, and it was supposed to be about this sort of guy who's fired from NASA and whatever, and he just develops this human alien hybrid in his bathtub. And then he realized there's some credibility issues in there. People won't buy this. So they just added the NASA. And it's basically like this sort of, I think it's just a very bare bones, sort of almost like a Western-y slash sort of, you know, police procedural, as in like someone's on the loose, let's find them, script on which shit has been built on.
I like the sympathy aspect. I think they should have just focused on that. Who cares about the team, honestly?
I think you're onto something, Nick, because it does start off with, you know, a half hour of Michelle Williams, and you are presented with this idea of caring. But then when she becomes fully mature after, you know, dropping out of the cocoon, then she's a
weirdly
a
looks
Terminator.
Like a vagina.
Yeah, very, very, very weird.
Very weird, and yeah, I don't know.
But then she's a weird predator, so the audience attention shifts, and then the focus is less on her, and it's more on the team tracking her down. So yeah, what the audience is supposed to do or follow or care about is constantly changing in an unnatural way. And yeah, that it does feel like a script that has been around for a while and had different forms and changed, and just it evolved in the hands of a production team that wanted to make this, because it seemed like this is stuff we could sell. Like if we have this and we make the alien naked, well then, you know, that'll sell tickets. And if we make it sort of dark and make it, you know, bring in Michael Madsen, bring in someone from Reservoir Dogs, bring in Patrick Stewart or someone like him. Oh, Ben Kingsley, perfect.
Bring in Patrick Stewart or someone like him. Ben Kingsley Ben Kingsley is the Patrick Stewart you can afford.
But it seems to be that this project had a life in the hands of producers and schmucks that are just trying to package and sell this. So what you get is a hobbled together production. They bring in Roger Donaldson, who has a resume, and probably, I don't know for sure, but probably has a resume of bringing things in on time and on budget. He's just one of those guys who I don't know of a film of his that I've really, really liked. I don't know if he has
Dante Speak? Come on. Cadillac Man?
Yeah. I really like The Bank Job, actually, with Jason Statham.
Okay. So, but he's a decent director, but, you know, is it his artfulness, or is he just a good hired gun? And that's what I think is. He's a good hired gun, and, you know, he'll direct it, and he'll make sure he gets good enough coverage for all the scenes, and then he'll drop off all the footage in the editing studio, and then he's done. So, I think it's just one of those Hollywood projects.
he's a Ron Howard you can afford.
Yes, because there's another guy, you know.
No, I
he can deliver it, but the strength of the project may lie in the script or what he happens to get out of the actors, as opposed necessarily to what Ron Howard can actually deliver. So that's how I take it, because there's a lot of elements in here that like should work. They work on paper, they worked in the promos, but it doesn't really all come together.
You know, I have a thing that the primary reason why the film doesn't really work for me is the fact that it's kind of, it is a bit of a mishmash of like, here's some alien, here's some aliens, here's some Terminator is a good shot actually, when you think about this, and then. But it's kind of like, it really wears its alien references on its sleeve, but it's kind of like, and it tries to look like Alien, but it looks like Alien you ordered from Wish. Like the opening title sequence is enough to tell you what quality of filmmaking you're going. I mean, I haven't seen this in 1995, so I can't testify to how good it looked at the time. Whether this is just the uncanny valley and whatever, and the fact that very early CGI looks like a hot garbage, looks like a Scotch egg Niccolo microwaved, right?
Yeah, or worse even.
Or looks like that Scotch egg I had to deal with after my Wonder Wheel scenario. This
after it left the cocoon.
Well, imagine left the cocoon in a blaze of glory and painted the bowl brown. Anyway.
Imagine the open credits that we see here and line them up to the opening credits of the 1978's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where you're sort of drifting through space. It's night and day, just the quality. And, you know, it's because this is, you know, digital and sort of half-ass effort in 1995. And, you know.
It's supposed to be like, I think it's supposed to be an homage to 1979 Alien, right? When the sort of the name Alien comes out of these sort of seemingly weird lines out of nowhere, three quarters through the screen. And it kind of goes this, has these sort of like two crescents. And then and it just goes, whoosh, whoosh, species. And it just, I think it flies off in front, in towards me. I'm like, this looks garbage. Like there are video games in 1995 that look better than this.
Oh well, I don't know about that.
Okay, maybe in 2001.
Yes.
But they clearly tried. Like there was, I feel like there. It's not, you know, there are films that you know people didn't give a shit about. And then they were just, I don't know, this is not like a Roger Corman production where there's like, we know it's made of out of styrofoam and Joan Saxon refused to wear makeup, okay? It's not one of those. It's something that people actually spent money on. It cost like $35 million to make and they got HR Giger involved and they were like, well, let's make this work. Let's make a memorable villain, let's make a memorable story, let's make the aliens of the 90s, and look how this turned out.
They tried, at least. Like I in some parts it doesn't feel half-assed. I think the cast definitely is committed in every kind of every way, for better or worse.
Well, apart from Ben Kingsley, who really wished somewhere else.
truly it's like, oh, I don't even die early, damn it. I wish. But yeah, and I think the practical effects in this are very effective. I think when you see the cocoon that we mentioned multiple times and some of the bodies and the gore, I think it looks very gnarly and
snaky little thing in the lab.
Yeah, and very, very tactile. Like it feels real, it feels tangible, which I always appreciate. But everything else, like, woof.
But there's still an effort to embrace the CGI at the time, like, and that doesn't totally work in the climax. You also have a shout out. I think a lot of 90s action films at the studio level that have a medium size or higher budget, I think there's a lot of emulation of T2, like, and you get that in the finale with you know, oh, well, in the 1990s, the only way you can get rid of a threat is
put
to
him in lava.
Dump them in lava or molten steel. Like, it's all we got.
But by the way, like, this is something that bothers me, like, logically. I don't want to jump. I mean, might as well. Let's jump into the ending a little bit. Where are they?
Oh. It's sewers that turns into a cave.
With a molten lava pool.
Well,
of course.
There's a pool of oil which ignites. I think that's what it is. Right.
Because it kind of looks like, is this? Are we in a sort of like a...
I'm with you. Where are we? And this is all, incidentally, under a huge hotel. You know, unbeknownst to engineer. Like, they take an elevator down to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have no idea where they are. I was actually trying to think, what the hell are they doing? What does this mean? And I think the idea might be in some way that the team that is trying to chase down and eradicate the alien is they're entering the alien's turf. That's somehow maybe visually, I don't know. But that's all I could come up with. That whole element sort of bothered me as well, just the geography and the logic of it.
So it kind of feels like, It feels almost like, I mean, there's an interest in there, I think, in the film, because it feels a little bit as the early 90s. Not that I watched all these films when I was at the time, because I was dangerously young for things like Basic Instinct and Sliver and things like Jade or whatever. There was this time between in early to mid 90s where the erotic thriller was the older rage, like, I suppose, starting from like the mid 80s, like from like mm-hmm. 9.5 weeks mm-hmm. and whatnot, Body Heat,
yeah,
right,
Fatal Attraction, and
yes. So it feels like it feels like someone sat down with this script that someone that was in, like, on, I don't know, on the blacklist or in the development hell, I don't know, some in someone's drawer, and said, well, how are we going to make this marketable? I know, let's get HR Giger involved, let's make this look like Alien and Aliens, because that sold very well, and let's put boobs and bush in there, because that sells. And it kind of just and then while they were working on this, T2 came out and just made box office absolute millions, right? And they were just like, yeah, let's just put all this together and see what comes out. So I feel this is like an interesting oddity in that regard.
I think you're exactly right. I think this is, like I said, I think this is pieced together at the production level. And I think the only other element I think that you did mention there is, let's get a hip cast, and Michael Madsen, mm-hmm. he's edgy, you know, let's get this type of cool cast. And
Forrest Whitaker, who was just about getting out there. Alfred Molina.
Yeah. Yeah.
Patrick Stewart you can afford.
And a Patrick Stewart that you can. Yeah.
Although I would assume that probably Ben Kingsley cost more because he wasn't already an Oscar winning entity.
It was in the Schindler's List as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's true, but he was entering a phase of his career where he was just taking, you know, paycheck jobs, six or seven, or might even be more. But A Sound of Thunder, this film reminds me a little bit of Peter Hyams' A Sound of Thunder, but that film is a complete and utter disaster because they spent their 60 or 70 million in all this pre-viz CGI stuff, but they didn't have enough money to finish, and it looks it. It's
really?
But, yeah, oh, yeah. Check it out. Like,
I'm googling this as we speak. It's 2005. Wow.
Yeah. Ben Kingsley's in that, and it just seems like he entered this part of his career where the Schindler's Lists and those types of films seem to dry up. I know he had an Oscar nomination after that. Was it House of Sand and Fog with Jennifer Connelly? Maybe.
I think so. Yeah.
So he has a few of those others, but he's also taking.
I've seen this.
Paycheck. Yeah, Peter Hyams, the guy that did
seen this.
Outland in 2010. It's unfinished. Like, the effects in that are just crazy. And yeah, Ben Kingsley, another paycheck job. Dropped by set for the weekend.
It's like, even in the 90s, Ben Kingsley was in what? In Sneakers? How big was Sneakers at the time? I'm not sure. It was supposed to be like this big ensemble cast, but that kind of came and went as well.
Yeah, I think it was just a medium-sized hit. I seem to recall it was released in the fall, which was it's never really a rockin' time to make money.
Mm-hmm. No. No, but in general, I kind of feel like Species is kind of one of those films that kind of works on paper when you think about it. Like, if I told you that, you know, there's this film about this experiment where they just get alien DNA and then combine it with a human, and they grow this human, and she escapes, and she turns out she's going to look for a mate, and then she's killing these people. She's like this sort of praying mantis slash a woman spider almost. She looks cool when she's in her alien form, and you just think to yourself, there are these almost X-Men just hunting her down because Forrest Whitaker, for some reason, he has a superpower.
My favorite superpower, empathy.
Empathy and care.
Have you ever seen Captain Planet?
No.
And the Planetarians? Oh my goodness, you're missing out. So there's this cartoon when I was young, I remember it was Captain Planet. Captain Planet, he was a superhero who was very pro-ecological. So the villains were these pigs in there who were dirty, and then like they rode these like diesel bikes and whatever. So there was just smoke everywhere. And then Captain Planet was a hero who was summoned, and there were these kids, teenagers, who were called the Planetarians. And they each one had a ring. There were five of them. There were five kids, and then each had a ring, one for each element. And but wait, there's only four elements, right? So there's earth, wind, fire, water, like all these cool elements. And all these rings had their own special powers. So they could, like someone who had this fire ring, they could summon fire and they would just shoot fireballs or like water balls and whatever. And they needed the fifth one. And there was this little ethnic guy with a monkey on his on his shoulder, and his power was heart. Heart, that, and then all he was doing, and he could
Forrest Whitaker.
Yes, so he could influence people and just change them from being villainous to be like, I feel like going home today. Like, so that's Forrest Whitaker to me.
Yeah, he's a freaking Care Bear.
But at least he's committed. That's the thing. At least, like, he's not taking it lightly, which is
I don't know how I feel about this. Like, I would have probably preferred if you went like full like wink wink, I'm taking the piss here, as opposed to just going Jared Leto on this.
I don't know. I'm sort of with Nick. There's something about Forrest Whitaker that I've always liked, and he's always been a memorable presence on screen, so I think he works here amidst all the silliness, because he is treating it seriously. And there's sometimes if someone treats something seriously, it does elevate it to a certain point that you can admire, and maybe sometimes it brings some heart to it. I'm not saying he brings heart to this on the whole, but he stands out, and he's an interesting presence. And I don't not like him, because other actors, if they do this, like, they just drift into the background and they summon and conjure eye rolls in me. It's like, oh good lord. He doesn't do that. He's just one, a unique presence. Ever since I first saw him in Bloodsport, I always remembered, like, geez, that guy's sort of
interesting. I just recently watched Bloodsport, and I was like, Forrest Whitaker is in this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my goodness, so nice.
My backlog on Letterboxd is massive. Like, I've got a whole list of stuff I need to put in there. But is it 1995? I think it is. Blown Away.
Blown Away is
93. That's 1994.
Or 4.
That's where I first saw him, I think. Forrest Whitaker was the sort of like this sort of cocky bomb squad guy.
Okay. I don't remember him in that.
That's directed by Stephen Hopkins. We need to do like a Stephen Hopkins retrospective. If you think about Dangerous Game, I want to do I remember why I was thinking about Stephen Hopkins the other day. Because I was thinking, I need to find an excuse for us to do an episode on The Ghost and the Darkness. Mm-hmm. And then I think at some point in the near future, we're doing a Stephen Hopkins film whose name will remain unsaid for now. And then I realized he also did Predator 2. Oh my goodness. And and Dangerous Game. And then I remember the Nicola you were mentioning, like, let's do some horrors from Australia. And that's an Australian slasher, right?
Yeah. Good choice. Good choice.
I always sort of associated Hopkins with Donaldson and Stephen Herrick comes to mind, but there's just some of those guys that just seem to be studio guys that could, you know, deliver the project on time, on budget, may or may not be any good. I sort of consider Hopkins and Donaldson sort of the same type of guy.
It kind of looks like this, you know, like when you think about, like, Hopkins was also kind of, what did he do? Like Nightmare on Elm Street 5. He did, he was second unit on Highlander, for instance, right? So, like, you know, he's an industrial sort of, he's an insider, right?
Right.
But yeah. Well, anyway, just moving things along a little bit. What do we think about? Because this was, I think, a point of like you were there, you were a paying customer when you saw this, right? The nudity. That was a point of contention for people, and then if you look at reviews, then people were actually actively pissed off about this.
I don't recall what are the arguments against it. Just that, like, it's so gratuitous.
Yeah, that it's gratuitous, and that's gratuitous, and also that it's exploitative when it comes to Natasha Henstridge, for whom this was her debut, right? Because by the way, film starts with, this is something that really doesn't happen very often, does it? Starring in alphabetical order, right? And then you see Ben Kingsley, Alfred Molina, and just like, and there's like six people, just like, do you have to rank them in alphabetical order, really? And then Natasha Henstridge, that's it. And then the alphabetical order is just out the window after like five or six people.
Why? Generally contract stuff, because in a contract they can be like, this has to be on screen just by itself, it has to be after this person, and blah blah blah. And if everyone has different clauses, it's like, yeah, alphabetical, everyone's happy.
Yeah, I suppose this makes sense. But yeah.
In the realm of, you know, gratuitous sex in the 90s, I don't see this as, you know, over the top. I don't feel it's exploitative, but, you know, exploitation, I think, has to do with, you know, how she's treated on set. You know, I imagine that Natasha Henstridge was sold on this project in the way that it may very well have been pitched as, God, this is going to sound silly, but as maybe like a prestige, a notable high-end production, because the iconography is there, because the marketing pieces are there. This has, you know, an easy sell in a way. Well, it's Alien meets Terminator meets Fatal Instinct, you know, with, you know, some cast of Reservoir Dogs, you know, so it you can sell it a little bit on, you know, that sounds really cool. So I think it did, like, it had a $35 million budget. It was released in the summer season, so it had a little bit of prestige attached to it. Roger Donaldson isn't a slouch either. Like, you know, I joke a bit and, you know, suggest maybe he's a hack, but, you know, he had done a lot of stuff by that point. Wasn't No Way Out with Costner? I didn't see that, but I understood that was sort of well received at the time.
Oh, so, 13 like, Days film.
That's one. The one. I think there is a No Way Out with Costner that might have been Donaldson, but yes, 13 Days.
That's, he did more than one with Costner.
Thank you for mentioning 13 Days. I
no
really
way
like
out,
that.
Yeah.
So, you know, this isn't necessarily of an exploitative pitch to Natasha Henstridge. I think that her modeling career was going quite well at the time, and if she was interested in making a jump to increase, you know, her exposure and sort of, you know, make a jump up forward in her career into film, you know, this probably looks like an enticing film. You know, you're basically going to be a female Terminator. You know, there is an element where, you know, you're hunting people for the sake of procreating, but it's probably sold as, you know, you're female Terminator. And I think that itself is a strong sales pitch. What about nudity? Well, she was a model, so you know, she was no slouch coming into this industry. Like, she was not green. She had a sense of, you know, how contracts worked around this. And I like to think that she was protected in that process. I know that she was taken advantage of in other elements of, you know, her career and dealing with other people, but I don't necessarily feel that that was part of her becoming part of this project. I think it probably looked like a good opportunity for her.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, it's not particularly excessive the way she's treated. It's definitely gratuitous for sure, but if you compare it to something like Showgirls from the same year, it's nowhere near as insulting as some might say. But yeah, I think that's when it just clicks that this movie does not want to say anything meaningful, because it's just parading her around Los Angeles or wherever it's set, just going from man to man. It's like, this might be the next one. She flirts because she keeps imitating what she sees around, and he's like, I'm gonna use this tactic because someone said, do it like this, you show off more of your body, and she's like strips in a club, things like that. It's cheap comedy as well, because it's played usually for comedic effect, and it leads nowhere. That's the thing. Like, I think that's the most insulting thing of this movie, is that we spend so much time with her and we ultimately learn nothing. Like, they take a character that could have had three dimensions and ends up having one. Predator, reproduce. That's it. Yeah. So it's like, okay. Mm. Cheap.
I feel there's a think piece somewhere in there about like how this is commenting about like the toxic masculinity of the 90s and Hollywood. Like, the guy she picks up at the bar, who goes and like insists on her having a shower. I'm taking a shower. Do you want to have one? Do you want to have a shower? I'm like, just really? Goes on the list. Hold on. Shower guy.
I mean, even the fact that the rest of the task force, let's say, that's assembled to get her, it's a sausage fest except for one woman. And she's the one that's always mistreated, always made fun of, always being like, oh, I don't know if that's right, blah, blah, blah. And it's not played for... not satirical, but
she's reduced to a love interest to Michael Madsen as well.
She has no sense of agency or urgency, and it's not played as a criticism of toxic masculinity and misogyny. It's just the reality of 1995.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
pretty much. It's very bleak, and they're all forgettable. Like, who cares? Who cares about, who remembers that lady? Who remembers Michael Madsen, to be honest? Like, if he was played by another actor, we wouldn't remember him. Let's be honest.
So, in light of all that we clearly see how much of a shit show this film is, as in, like, you know, it's piecemeal, it's Lego block filmmaking, right? That's made not with heart of any kind. It's almost like a corporate, you know, like, There are films made by people, and there are films commissioned by a company, designed and executed by a committee of people with God knows how many PowerPoint presentations in between, right? This kind of feels like one of them. So how did it end up spawning three sequels, a book, and a comic book? Why?
Well, to be honest, like, Hellraiser spawned the 9 sequels. It got progressively worse. I think it's because it's titillating. It's an excuse for people to watch, you know, it's a fetish in a weird way, because people have a thing for sci-fi aliens, naked ladies. Ooh, that's fun. That's exciting. And the fact that they got progressively cheaper. I know the second one.
Have you actually seen any of them, by the way?
No. I've seen trailers. That was more than enough.
I saw the second and the third one this week as well.
Oh my!
A trooper.
Yeah.
We need an opinion on the ground in here.
The second was also released at theaters, as you were saying, but you know, it's just getting lesser and lesser in quality, and the third one is straight to television.
Straight to sci-fi, yeah.
Yeah, and you've got a little bit of a budget for a little bit of an action scene at the end. Otherwise, it's a lot of talking scenes, and they redo the alien in a suit, and you've got a control room with a lot of monitors blinking and red lights going off, and crap is explained in terrible science dialogue. It's horrible.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how a film that you know it's bad, like there's no pretending that it was good, right? Even like you read reviews from the time, it's kind of like, what, Alien meets V meets Splash meets Playboy's erotic fantasies : forbidden liaisons diluted into a diffuse misdirected bore. You know, this, I don't know, it's you look at the sort of, because it's difficult to kind of find the sort of people's response at the time, because the internet wasn't a thing, so you don't have permanent record of people's tweets, right?
I think it's sort of like I was saying in the opening, and Nick as well, it's the burger looked good on the menu, so it looks good in the promotional materials, and there are these enticing toppings for the pizza, but really there's no base. It's mm-hmm. just a couple exciting tasty elements. And that's enough for a franchise. It's if you've got imagery, if you've got marketing materials, if you've got a legacy such as it is, a film that made $65 million or so in North America and 120 altogether, it's got a leg to stand on. It's got a little bit of a legacy that people can reach back to, and it's got memorable and recognizable iconography. That's enough. That's enough for a crap sequel with a $2-3 million budget.
I'm just wondering this because, was it just the 90s that if something made three times its budget, that means like definitely it's going to have a sequel?
Probably.
I think that's been a moving target, the three times. I think now, because there's so much effort put into marketing overseas, like there's a lot more marketing costs involved now. I always recall it being around double the budget. I think as well, studios have also clawed into the ticket price. So they take a greater and greater chunk of the ticket price than they did. So theaters, distributors probably had a half or so of the ticket price back in the 90s, but I doubt they do now.
Well, now it's almost 70%.
Yeah.
Goes to, leaves the cinema. So buy your popcorn, kids. Just if you like your cinema, buy food, because that's how they pay the bills. Yeah. I don't know, Nick, you wanted to say something?
No, I think also I can imagine a large quantity of adolescent teens buying tickets for other movies to then sneak into this one. And
So you think there's like silent box office that for some reason, like, yes. Titanic was, this is why Titanic was such a big hit or something. Was it in 1995?
97 for South Park. Wow.
So yeah. What else was in cinemas in 1995 in
October?
July, sorry.
Babe.
See,
pig.
People buying tickets for Babe and sneaking into Species.
Babe and Apollo 13.
Why? It writes itself. Why didn't it writes itself.
Why didn't I think of this when I was younger? Anyway.
Oh, they check here, so you cannot do that.
Opportunity lost, yeah.
I'm thinking about this. I feel like there's, honestly, when you look at, on paper, there's an opportunity in here. As in, because not everything, at least to my mind, like Basic Instinct, fine, had a sequel, right? Hollow Man had a sequel. Not everything lends itself to a sequel very well, and I think there has to be some momentum in the story, or there needs to be marketability, or just their reproducibility in whatever they're dealing, right? And it just, by design, it's supposed to be this sort of melting pot of inspirations taken from like T2, Alien, and V, and whatever. So it kind of looks like, let's just do more of this. It lends itself to a world building situation, not only just to make a sequel, but just like, how about you can ask yourself questions. Are there more of these aliens? What's going to happen if there's another one? What happens if there's a man? Is the second one about a man?
The second one is a man. He's an astronaut, and he gets infected on Mars and brings it back. And they had cloned Natasha Henstridge, but they had her in a cage the whole time. But then they need to use her because she's a good guy. So it's more of the T2 thing. She's now a good guy because she can also track the man.
Oh, Jesus. What a mess.
Sounds super fun. Sounds and exciting.
No, but I'm thinking to myself, because this thing spawns like 3 sequels, a book and a comic book. So clearly there's some need for like exploration of what the character is like, or what the race of these aliens is like. I feel like there's something to that sort of fan sort of world building aspect of this.
Yeah, I don't necessarily understand these smaller subsidiary markets based on the successful originals. When you guys talked about Alien Nation, was it? I'm not familiar with those comics, so I don't really know the market that they're hitting or the size of the market. I imagine it's small and it's niche, but it probably is strictly focused on the world. It's not a character thing. I can't imagine it's a character thing. It's just maybe sci-fi nuts that have an interest in these particular sci-fi representations. And I imagine it's a very small, small type of market that they're trying to hit.
You can get different audiences this way, different target audiences as well.
Like, I feel this, in the aftermarket, like in the secondary market, this hit with like the sort of the nerd audiences, because now I'm watching this and I'm actively thinking that this character of Natasha Henstridge could have been an inspiration for the character of Kerrigan in StarCraft. Just because, or at least part of this, because like they pulled just left, right, and center from like James Cameron's filmography, just in general, right? When they were like designing things for StarCraft, so I don't know. I feel like there is a little bit to it, and then when you actually try to be cynical about this, this may actually be just down to the fact that H.R. Giger's design is just cool looking.
Is it?
Well, here's a good question, because I feel like apart from the alien is like a flash in the pan to me, because you look at H.R. Giger's stuff and you feel like I think I'm done with this penis fetish. Like, I'm sorry. Like, does it really look good? Like the alien design, by the way, like what do you guys think about the sort of the Syl as a concept alien design?
What I like about the Syl design, so in Natasha Henstridge's the human form, I think just sort of a strong posture and just that like the stern chin. I think Natasha Henstridge is really, really good for what she's doing. Like, she has that look. And I think she's the template for the character in Battlestar Galactica that Trisha Helfer plays. Mm-hmm. So there's that. In terms of the H.R. Giger representation of Syl, the alien suit, it's fine. It's not special to me. I don't particularly find the nipple tentacles all that interesting. But
how very hentai.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's overly designed. There's just too much going on with her design, with the look, with the tentacles. It's just constant movement. It's crowded. It's a crowded visual that doesn't stick into my mind. Even during the climax, it's just kind of like this weird like yellowish goldish exterior. It's like, I prefer the, even though they're very poorly just shot, but like the nightmares that she has.
Do you like very them?
No, but I like the design of the train. It's like, that's more of an H.R. Giger thing, but the nightmares are shit.
You mean the train with the like the skulls?
Yeah, they've like this weird distortion effect on top of it. Just why? Mm-hmm. You can't make anything out. H.R. Giger spent $100,000 of his own to make those scenes possible, and it was not worth it. But I like the design. That's the thing. That's more of a classic design for him. Very gothic, and it looks great. But the alien itself, I don't think it's anywhere near a memorable and good design, in my opinion.
She's not scary. Like, if you think about the xenomorph from Alien, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. I was just about to say, like, we never see her in full view almost, and then whenever we do, it's in full CGI, which is gross.
Mm-hmm. It's terrible. Yeah.
But then we never see the full alien. I mean, almost never see the full alien in 1979's Alien, right? Like, maybe apart from like one or two scenes and towards the end, when I think when Ripley's in the suit and then it's all in strobe and you can see like it's just, you know, floating space. I don't know.
It's, yeah, a lot is covered in the shadows. And as a result, doesn't Pitch Black do that not too bad? Keeps the aliens in shadows at least for a long, long time. And
yeah, that it costs fuck all to make.
So. Yeah. And it increases the, you know, just the eeriness or the creepiness of it when you don't have to show the bad CGI fully lit or the bad rubber suit fully lit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. And yeah, I don't know. It's like, to me, the idea of having an HR Giger concept in 1995 is actually better than looking at the concept itself reduced to practice. I'll put it that way. Like, it just looks, everything looks rushed in here. And it's just ruined by the fact that half of it's just ruined by CGI, for instance. Like, there's this Michelle Williams transformation in the very beginning when she matures into a Natasha Henstridge by way of steaming brown vagina that apparently eats the conductor, who was a nice person. It just looks bad. Like, when, like, it's a scary scene when you see something's just protruding from her face, and then like you see these tentacles coming out and you clearly see that they're composited in. It just, no, doesn't work.
They tried. They saw Jurassic Park success. They saw T2 success. We need to do the CGI because that's what kids like nowadays. It was just not ready. The technology wasn't there and the time wasn't there to make it polished.
No. Yeah.
Was it not there because Jurassic Park, like, my recollection is that's pretty slick and well done CGI, and is you know, is in,
that's ILM, in with the by actors. The way, so you know.
Yeah, so different company. Yeah, so but yeah, it doesn't work here, and it's not really for a few more years until like Lord of the Rings and the Star Wars prequels that you really get that immersive and more successful use. And even, you know, at times some of that isn't the greatest, but certainly here, and we're probably only talking 30 or 40 CGI shots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably. It's,
and plus some inserts, I suppose. Right.
Yeah.
But then
I remember the times where they would put like, oh my God, this movie has 30 CGI shots. Oh, that's insane. And I'm like, this movie has 20 shots without CGI. Oh, my boy.
Yeah.
Well, Avengers Endgame says, hold my beer. This whole shit has been previous 3 years ago anyway.
That's
so
right. Yeah. Yeah.
We don't even need the actors.
Pretty much.
I seem to remember there was a big hoo-ha about the Final Fantasy film that was like a full CGI sort of affair, and that looked garbage.
It looked like a cinematic from the games from the time, which is fitting, honestly.
Yeah, but then the thing about cinematics from the game is kind of like, I'm done with them after like 45 seconds. I think I'm tired already. And by the time I'm tired, they're already finished. And this is like a 90 minute film. Anyway, but like with the CGI, like there's, I think one of the main sort of problems with it is that it's just almost always in, like, they didn't quite know yet that they have to hide stuff in shadows. Like, it's all in full lit sort of mode. Mm. Like, she cuts her finger off, which it seems great. That the idea of, like, which I don't quite know why, but the idea of she just grabs a pair of scissors, she just hacks off her finger. Great, great moment. And then just ruins immediately by these CGI tentacles coming out.
Why? Yeah, and that whole scene is, like, to me, that whole scene just narratively speaks to a bigger confused problem that exists with the film, because Natasha Henstridge, is she like a Terminator, like cold and heartless? Is she like this creature, or is she more like a methodical, thinking, diabolical villain? Because that's a very well thought out plan. And I think that is an example where it points to just sort of a sloppy construct. And this just doesn't come together and was you know, a bunch of different ideas from a bunch of different people that put it together. No matter how many names are on the screenplay, I'd say a lot of people had their thumbs in this pie. It's just what it feels
mm-hmm.
like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it is, you know, it makes sense when you think about this. Because I'm watching the last quarter of the film, and you feel like it's just like, I don't know, like they were almost out of their own ideas, and they were just like, let's just remake the Alien for now. Like, so give these people flamethrowers, put this in sewer. So it's kind of like, oh, I was honestly waiting for a 1995 Wish.com remake of this sort of iconic scene where Newt's in the water and the alien pops up behind her. Like, I was waiting for a scene like this. I didn't get one. Great.
Too expensive.
It wasn't in the budget. It was probably thought of.
No, but then kind of felt like it was going that direction already. And then it ends like Terminator 2 ends, and it's just weird. And oh, by the way, on the bingo card, Jakob's finding another sort of piece of score that's openly borrowing from Jerry Goldsmith. Did you notice?
No.
No? Oh, hold on. I'm doing this. I'm sorry. This is me doing this. I'm doing this. I'll find this. Did you hear this? Yeah. So that, hold on. Just keep this in mind. That's Christopher Young, by the way, who also, did he do Invaders from Mars?
It did?
I think he did.
One of the movies from the last retro, yeah. He made Hellraiser, I believe, too.
Can you hear this? That's Jerry Goldsmith. So can you hear this? That was Jerry Goldsmith. On the opening, when the sort of the pods and alien just open up, and then they just wake up from their hypersleep. So that's just openly, even on the score level, they're asking Christopher Young to go like, how about you just make sure that this kind of sounds like Alien, okay?
Yeah.
They probably had temp tracks, yeah. You know.
Yeah, wouldn't
make it like that. Make it sound like that.
Anyway, I think I've run out of things to say apart from like Mini and Big Uglies. So, final thoughts on this? Because I don't know. Like, I think we've talked about species for longer than anybody else in the world has ever talked about species. Final take, Randy?
Well, as I said in the opening, like there's enough interesting nuggets here. I was interested to see if either of you had experienced enough joy in this that you might sway me to a little bit more of a positive. But
nope.
sort of the opposite. I was coming in at a B minus, a B minus type of film, and yeah, if anything, it might be a C plus now. Or at any rate, it's a hobbled together, unfortunate mess. I can see how it was made, and it really was a production that was thrown together with a bunch of ideas, and there wasn't really an artist at the helm. You know, it's not this needed a Cameron, this needed one of the Scott boys, this needed someone with a firm understanding of
Paul Verhoeven
moments. Paul Verhoeven, oh. Perfect.
He could have knocked the shit out of this script.
Or Cronenberg or Alex Garland. Like these guys.
Alex Garland was my age, probably.
True.
So he was like 11.
That script would have kept, I'm sure.
He's probably not. But, no, he's older than I am, right? How old is Alex? Holy shit, he's 51. Sorry.
Is he?
Yeah.
Interesting. But someone that had an idea how to focus this thing, focus the threat, and you know, and engage the audience, and really develop the suspenseful moments, and it doesn't really have that. You have a few moments of, you know, fun. I'll say that with, you know, some of the performances and some of the scenes, but it's almost incidental or accidental. It's just not great. It's just not a great film.
It's just like short and sweet. It's just not great. I'm sorry.
Yet, in a decade, I could probably see myself returning to this because...
Oh, no.
Short-term memory loss, that's why.
Well, I might be approaching that age, but at the same time, like there are the pieces here. They are the elements that are enticing to a sci-fi fan that are, you know, that are doable, that, you know, that are exciting enough. So I could see myself returning to this if I haven't seen this in a decade, say, yeah, that should be sort of cool. It's got an alien and
And then you actually watch it. And it's like, so that's why I didn't like it.
You'll tell me, remember 720 episodes ago, we talked about that and none of us liked it.
Honestly, this would be amazing if 10 years from now, we're still doing this. And then at some point, we'll just have a segment of like what I watched this week and whatever. And Randy goes like, ah, I rewatched Species, by the way, guys. This rocks.
Well, that's an uncut gem.
All right. We'll bend the page on this one. We'll dog ear it and return to it in a decade.
Nick?
Yeah, no, there are times when we discuss certain films and we're like, oh, cool, I never thought I would enjoy this film. This is not one of them. I was dreading it. I was like, this has a reputation. This is an infamy. And I don't want to say it surpassed it, because honestly, it's not as bad as I was expecting it would be, which probably made it worse, because it's not schlocky. It needed to be schlocky, and it's not classy, let's say, for lack of a better word, than it probably could have been. It's just a wasted opportunity. You can see like parts of an idea forming that could have been effective, could have been a success, could have been a proper cult classic from the time. And all it is just an excuse to have a retread of more famous sci-fi films, but with more nudity. That's it. That's a no from me.
Same. I'll put it that way. I stand by my initial description of this being an alien order from Wish. That's what it is. It's just, this is not a good film. And I like the idea of watching this more than actually the film itself. The idea of saying, how about we watch Species? This was an exciting like 5 minutes before the film actually started and just ruined everything for me. It's not great. It has its moments, which we'll get to in a very, very little second. But overall, I don't feel like I feel the need to rewatch it ever again. And I'm just cured out of the idea of even just thinking about watching the sequels. I think I'm done. And I'm so happy that it's on this sort of MGM add-on to my Amazon Prime subscription, because I was this close to buying the sort of Species box set from 88 Films for £35.
Oh my God, man.
But it's a beautiful box set, all four of them. It has a book, has posters, it's the full shebang. Because 88 Films, when they released it, like, they have an Anaconda box set as well that I'm just this close to buying.
No. You need an intervention.
Wait.
No. It's enough that I really, you know, like, I got this.
At least those are good movies, you know.
Well, Child's you say that some of them are good. I mean, some, like, I have a history of Chucky as a character. Like, you know, like this goes to my childhood anxieties. Anyway, Species. I'm happy to have watched it because it saved me a lot of money and time on rewatching or watching the sequels and potentially buying this piece of shit, because it's not a good film. And even Forrest Whitaker couldn't save this, which we'll get to in a second. Anyway, so. The favorite moment of the episode for everyone involved, I hope. Top threes and bottom threes. Give us your tops, Randy.
Okay, so there's any one of a number of things that if you're having fun with it and you're really getting into the cheese, then you can see it as a top moment, and or a bottom moment. So as an honorable mention, I'll throw the deadly nipple tentacles. That's just sort of bizarre and weird. It's unique. I have an appreciation Check. For it. Okay.
nipple tentacles.
Yeah, the DNTs. So
it's freaking gross.
Number three, the cast. Except for Kingsley, they're taking it seriously, and you know they're doing a good job with the material that they have, and they're watchable. Like no one's really bad in it, and like we were saying, I think Forrest Whitaker is just great. Like he's more often than not a solid presence, even if he's got sort of a flat character. So I sort of liked him. Number two, I did like the hot tub scene. So the second guy that she courted and wanted to be with, the guy that paid her health insurance.
It's a tentacle in the mouth.
Yeah. And it's just such a bizarre scene. That's a Me Too moment. Oh, well, yeah, a lot of that in this. But the top, it's just so bizarre when you watch it. So they're starting to make out. She's weirdly aggressive. And then, I want a baby. Like, that's just a weird line. It creeps him out. But Henstridge is taking it incredibly seriously. Meanwhile, you have Madsen and Mark Helgenberger, they break in, you know, they don't have jurisdiction or authorization. One of them's a scientist, one of them's an independent contractor, but they break in. You have, to me, one of the best CGI effects is the eye morphing, and it's happening in a bush or something. You just see a close up of the eye. That's in here. You got a bit of creepiness, and it ends with sort of a funny and sort of awkward moment too, which works for me, is the squirrel jumping on Mark Helgenberger. That's so random. So that whole package as a scene was all right, sort of worked for me. But the absolute best, the highlight in this, was every time Michael Madsen carried a gun, he was phenomenal. So in one moment, he jumps out of an elevator. You see him, you can't see him, and then he jumps out of an elevator and he's in a squat position down on his, basically on his hands and knees, and he's holding the gun out. His team runs out into a parking lot and they walk around the car, but not Michael Madsen. He jumps up on the hood and he does the squat and point the gun thing again.
Yeah, it's not on my list. Why is he on the hood?
Why is he jumping on the hood? Like, this is not a high intense moment, but Madsen is highly intense. It's like, yes, I'm an action hero. This is going to be the way I'm going to do it. He also
Michael's on cocaine, so just
also one of these moments, he has no jurisdiction to be doing anything yet. He's walking around the house. He has his gun drawn. Mark Helgenberger's behind him, and he's sneaking around a door, and the camera's on the inside of the house, watching him sneak around a patio glass door, and you can see everything he's doing. It's like, why is he behaving this way? As if he's on
maybe
the other
it's
side
a
of a wall.
Mirror.
Well, maybe there's another moment where he's kneeling again, practically on his hands and knees, and he crawls and peeks around the corner. It's awesome. And then there's a great moment just as they're getting into the elevator to descend into hell, because the hotel's elevators goes to an oil pit. So the button on the elevator probably says OP for oil pit, because they. Because they go to the basement. But while they're waiting for the elevator, he holds his gun up and it's a head and shoulders shot. And, you know, in a very cool fashion, he just ejects the clip and puts in a new clip. And he just leaves the clip on the floor of the elevator. It's just great. It's like every time he brandishes his weapon, it's like he's doing something crazy with it. I loved it. Every single time.
Handling. You had me at Michael Madsen jumping on the hood of the car, and I remembered everything. It came to me flooding in, and now it's just brilliant. Five stars.
He's just got this weird, casual, like, I'm a film star, damn it. And anyway,
this cocaine's not going to snort itself.
He's great. And he and Mark Helgenberger, apparently they improvised their sex scene, and he's just, Michael Madsen is just fantastic in this. There you go. That's
by the way, did you think that Alfred Molina was wearing a courtesy sock? Because there's a lot of nudity and a lot of rubbing in there.
Oh, what I loved his line after he says, "Oh, that was immensely enjoyable." After he has sex with Natasha, it's just, "Oh, that was immensely lovely," or something. It was just he had a great moment there too. I should have mentioned that.
Okay, boys, we need to make a pact in here. Everyone, we need to just deploy this in action at one point and then see how the lady actually takes it. That was immensely enjoyable.
Why, thank you. Likewise, we hope.
Anyway, Nick?
Anyway, well, number three, I like the fact that they joke about the fact that they choose a female predator, hoping that it would be more docile. Like the only element of like criticism of misogyny in the entire script. It was kind of funny. Second, I love every scene with Forrest Whitaker and Alfred Molina. The two of them play wonderfully well off each other. I would watch a rom-com about the two of them going to Las Vegas, reading the room, trying to hook up with chicks. That would be very fun. And lastly, early on in the movie, I really liked the birthing scene where the younger version of Seal transforms into the older one. Natasha Henstridge and Michelle Williams like switch roles. It's very good. It's very nasty. And that's when I was thinking, this could be actually a good ride, you know?
Nope.
It wasn't.
Is that all?
Yep.
Okay, I've got a honorable mention to that scene. It's like a weird piece of comedy because that kind of happens in there sometimes. Where I can't remember whether this is Forrest Whitaker saying something like this. She's a predator. Or maybe it was Michael Madsen. I can't remember who this was. She's a predator. She has eyes in front. She has to judge distance. And then it's just like, that's such a Discovery Channel fact. And he's just like, how did you know this? I saw it on Discovery Channel. I saw a documentary. It just had me there. Had me at hello. Okay. Number three is just the tie between the kill through the mouth, and just like, come and give us a kiss, and then just goes full on alien chest burster through the guy's back of the head, tied with the just a lady who didn't do anything wrong in the toilet getting her spine ripped out, and this image of this sort of spine just sticking out, which is fucking gross, but it's violent. So okay, another the finger chopping scene, really like it. And then, absolute top, is Michelle Williams eating a banana.
Just, like she's never seen a banana before.
The method acting, eating a banana with the peel sideways. Like, it's just, how do we show this woman, this girl is an alien? Give her a banana and just don't tell her how to eat it. It's just, yeah, that's my tops. Bottoms, boys. Randy?
I thought of something. I'll throw it in here as a top. I thought it was incredibly cheesy and totally worked for me. The guy that she picked up, the first guy who is the real shithead, he takes her home and he walks into his pad and he snaps his fingers and the lights go on. And
I'm telling you, it's Brett Ratner.
Yeah. Yes. And then he snaps his fingers again and the music goes on or it activates something else. And I was like, that is terrible. This guy deserves to die. So, and then sure enough, he did. So I'll throw that in because I forgot that.
People used to buy the clapper, right?
Yeah, that's what it is. And I always sort of like when the clapper shows up because it's just such a weird and obnoxious thing. That's something. Has David Lynch ever used the clapper? That seems like something that that he could use.
Yeah, I could imagine. Like I can imagine quirky. David Lynch using a clapper in a scene where someone has to do an applause, and there were just like people clapping, and the lights keep going and going.
Yeah, like a really intense scene. And someone's cheering on some evil happening, and then
just a light strobe.
Flickering. So, anyway, yeah. So, okay. So for the bottoms, okay. So I'm gonna say it here as well, just because it's one of those weird, awkward things. It was on my top list, but Mini Ugly is also the DNTs, the Deadly Nipple Tentacles. it just, it belongs on both lists. It's just so weird. Okay, number three, in just in general, the dialogue, there's a lot of really bad dialogue. there's the Discovery Channel bit, and I like that, but there's some stuff that's terrible. The lab says that she's dead. You've got your test. I've got my gut. And they're trying to find out, well, where did Syl go? Like, she was here.
I'm telling you, she's going to go that way.
Yeah.
No one's and listening.
Then a bouncer says, oh, Robbie. Robbie left with a blonde. And, you know, Mr. Empath, the Care Bear, Forrest Whitaker says, yeah, that's him. Like, he has so many terrible lines. Yeah, that's him. I'll go this way. I think she went this way. I feel she went this way. Like, it's just, it's a lot of bad stuff. And then they have to explain things. She's trying to reproduce. She's trying to mate. Reproduce. Like, yeah, I got it. You only had to say it once. So, yeah, the dialogue.
Is in the audience.
It's like when the camera died in there. It's like, oh, it's going to take 3 days to replace the camera. What the fuck are you talking about? I'm doing it every day. Well, I'll need a hand. And then it's like, it's replacing a camera. Like, and they're just like, like drawing straws. It's just like, who's going to die?
Yeah. But the twist is no one did. All right. So, yes. So, Syl is listening to Michael Madsen and Marek Helgenberger have sex through the door. And then she goes into the next room and she knocks on the door, just as knocks on the door, housekeeping, and walks in. That is terrible etiquette. That drove me crazy.
What kind of a hotel is it?
Totally. This, my family and I, we just recently were on a trip and we were in a lot of hotels and this happened. And, you know, people were changing and it's like, what? Just housekeeping and walk right in. Terrible etiquette. So, but then again, I say this and Syl's an alien. So how would she know any better, I guess? But anyway, the housekeeping moment.
By the way, because I've got it on my list and it's already pretty long, so I might as well just add to it. The housekeeping, remember when we were recording Wild at Heart and I had to make a note about housekeeping in a hotel? That's what I wanted to make. It's at night.
Yeah.
And there's housekeepers. You know, like, what kind of a hotel is it that they pay the housekeeping staff to stay there off after hours? Like, there's this housekeeper just, like, locking the doors, just like, what?
That's right. And they've gone up after, yeah, they've been at the bar for a while. So, yeah, you're right. Weird.
So, off the list.
And done. Finally, for me, like, and we've talked about it, the ending with the elevator goes down to the sewer, and then there's an opening in the wall that descends through a rocky crevice to a pit of oil. And just everything that happens there is stupid. The geography of the scene is stupid. Just the whole thing is terrible.
There you go. Nick?
Number three is the Alfred Molina sex scene. It's one of those moments that's taken very seriously and it's hard.
It was a highlight of his career, if you think about it. He had a naked Natasha Henstridge sitting atop of him.
Jeez. Blessing. At least he had a good time, probably.
It was immensely lovely.
It was indeed immensely lovely. Second, of course, like we talked about the CGI being terrible, but those nightmares / dream sequences, just garbage effects. I don't know how they did them analog-wise, but just, properly unwatchable. But of course, number one, empathy is not a superpower. Doesn't matter how much mumbo-jumbo you splice around it, it's not a superpower that makes you predict, I don't know, everything, apparently. Just pissed me off so much. Like, as soon as they said it, I was like, oh no, they're not going to abuse his power. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, everything is a good excuse for him to move the plot forward, I guess. Out of convenience.
I feel she went that way.
Yeah,
that's a get out of jail free card. It's just like, how do we?
Yes, exactly.
Just like, we don't have to just write in just motivations or logic into the script. No, just like,
he feels it.
She's there. And meanwhile, Ben Kingsley's dying like right next to him. Yeah,
terrible.
Okay, so Now, this is the right list, because I may have listed one thing from my list when we were recording Wild at Heart. Forrest Whitaker taking off his cap every time he walks into a room. He just takes off his cap. And that's kind of just weird. I don't know. It's just, why does he have this cap? Like, do we? Yeah, I don't know. And then also when Forrest Whitaker just, I don't know, in this sort of compartment when they see this mold conductor. I think it's Forrest Whitaker who says this, something bad happened here. Like, no shit. It's a murder scene.
Okay. But see, because he's an empath.
We needed him. Yeah.
the audience needed him.
Okay. Car horn out of nowhere. That's another one that bothered me. Like when she walks across the street and this and a car stops, and I rewound it. There's a car horn sound, but the guy in the car doesn't press the horn. It just sits there. I'm like, am I to believe that there's another car behind him going like, what the fuck? Or is this just an ADR? Yeah. It's just in post, someone added the car horn, but because they forgot the guy was so, I don't know, taken aback by Natasha Henstridge's beauty. So that's off the list. Okay. Now, the door in the lab scenario, like they engineer a drama around this sort of experiment. They lose a bolt through the floor. What kind of a lab is this, by the way? whenever floor, it drops something on the floor, it's like, that's gone now. Like how ineffective and how just annoying, how much shit they have underneath the floor, by the way, because I suppose people work in there, right? And then something's gonna fall on the floor. It's just like, well, I suppose we need to get a new one because that's gone, right? And then they have this sort of, like, I need to burn the lab. And he has a button that says burn. this is my type of cheese, right? But I like that cheese, but it kind of just fizzles out into them just leaving the room. Just they leave the door, just close the door behind them just quickly. That's it. That's all it took. They should have done this like 2 minutes ago when this thing was just a little sponge. But anyway, so that's the door in the lab. The cyanide canisters, the whole concept of just having this dome in the lab and then decided we need to kill this person, so let's just gas them like the Nazis. With fucking cyanide, big containers that say cyanide, and of course something goes wrong, she breaks the glass and everyone in the room dies. And I'm just thinking, like, Ben Kingsley should be dead now. I don't know, but maybe his room is a bit well ventilated. I don't know, so that's cyanide done. Okay, the shower guy can fuck off. It's just, do you want to take a shower? And the last remaining two, and it kind of just goes into what Randy said, just the entire ending of, like, the pit of hell is great. It's just horrible stuff, which is on a remake of Alien and then coming into becoming T2. Anyway, but the concept of kid alien just coming out of her back and then just being a thing, and then has this tongue. Gross. Why is it there? And just the cherry on top is the rat alien as a stinger at the end. Like, why? What's happened?
Sequel bait. We love to see it.
Yeah, so that's me. Anyway, so that's it. So Species can be streamed. If you live in America, Species can be streamed on Prime. In Canada, it's on Tubi. In the UK, it's on an add-on channel to Amazon Prime, which is an MGM channel. In Italy,
Just don't watch it.
Or if you really hate yourself, go on, if you live in Region 2, go on 88 Films website and buy the box set of all four Species films. It's a beautiful box. If you never saw them, you could convince yourself this must be amazing because it looks great. The box looks amazing.
That's how they get your money. Maybe it's not that bad.
Yeah, so that's it. So how about we did it. Randy, tell us, where can we find you and your stuff?
You can find me on Twitter @RandyBurrows. You can find me on Letterboxd @Bratch7. And you can find me whenever I write some articles on clapperltd.co.uk.
Legendary. Now, Nick, where can we find you?
NickyGuerra97 on every social, Niccolo Grasso on Letterboxd. Enjoy the movies on YouTube and Vimeo, and listen to the Death by Deputation podcast.
Legendary. And then you can find me, talk about film on Twitter, Jakub Flash, Letterboxd, flashonfilm.com. What else? That's it. yeah, and also remember, follow the show, Uncut Gems Pod everywhere, which is Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. Yep. And also uncutgemspodcast.com is our HQ, so you head over there to kind of find all the episodes and links and everything. It's there. We're also on Clapper, clapperltd.co.uk. Also remember to subscribe to our Patreon. Patreon.com/uncutgemspod is the place to go to listen to extra podcasts from us, such as Bonus Tie-ins this month, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, mini retrospectives this month, Invaders from Mars, Shivers, and Body Snatchers, which is a Body Snatcher sort of little retrospective, and the Wild at Heart addition to our ongoing 2022 David Lynch marathon. So plenty of stuff to listen to over on at our Patreon. So $3 ain't much, and it helps us stay afloat and pay for the website. Also, you can send us, if you want to support us, you can always buy us a coffee. coffee.com/uncutgemspod is the place to go. And then if you don't want to support us by giving us your hard-earned cash, you can also leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcast, so be it Apple, Spotify, or I don't know where. Leave us a review, leave us a rating. That helps a lot. And that's about it. So stay tuned until next week, because next week we are continuing our series about snatchers, body snatchers and shapeshifters. But this time I think it's going to be more body snatching than shapeshifting, because I think we're talking the faculty. So get ready for some Robert Rodriguez action. And in the meantime, I hope you have a fabulous day. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.